Well, Leanne, it looks like a piece of rock over here. What exactly is this?
Well, it's not any old piece of rock. It's the Cranbourne meteorite, which is one of 12 meteorites found around Cranbourne, actually part of one larger meteorite. Now, a meteorite is a piece of rock that's actually come from space. The meteors go through the Earth's atmosphere and don't actually hit the Earth. A meteorite is one that actually hits the Earth. So these were found
down at Cranbourne. So that's pretty local then, this one.
Yep, it's a local boy. We've actually got a few of them in the museum's collection. We've actually got another one on display at Melbourne Museum. And we have got a few different meteorites here. This one there is just from space somewhere. They're not exactly sure where it is. We do have some that have come from Mars, and we know that they're definitely from Mars. The good thing about this one is that you can touch it, you can climb on it, you can do whatever you like with it. It's not that valuable that we have to keep it in a case. So it's really good. You can actually touch something from outer space.
So, wow, I'm actually touching something that's been in outer space. How big is this one?
Oh, it's 680 kilograms. It doesn't look that heavy, does it?
No.
It's fairly small.
It doesn't look quite... I mean, that's as much as a small car.
Yeah, that's right. Mostly iron, so yes. It's very heavy, a heavy rock. Yeah.
Okay. And over here we've got a few smaller ones. What's the go on these?
These are the Henry meteorites. We've got quite a few of these. Again, they're iron, and they're actually really heavy compared... They're about the size of a fist. One's 1.5 kilograms, and one's 3.2 kilograms. And some information about it here. It actually hit the Earth's surface around 4,700 years ago.
And where is Henbury?
About 145 kilometres southwest of Alice Springs.
In the Northern Territory.
That's right.
Okay. And now we're over here, and a different sort of rock, but quite a small one. What's this?
This is a meteorite from Mars. Very, very valuable, and in fact, the case that it's in is actually alarmed.
Oh, so I'm not going to take it home tonight, then?
No, no one's going to take it home tonight, and in fact, the alarm does go back to the security section. It's one of the really valuable items in the museum's collection.
Who owns it?
It's owned by Museum Victoria. We actually have two Mars meteorites. They're very rare. There's only 36 meteorites that have actually been proven to come from Mars.
And how do you know it's from Mars and not from a tektite from the Earth or just sample from the Moon, perhaps, or just an ordinary meteorite?
The chemical composition is consistent with what we believe is on Mars. The rovers that are there at the moment are making sure of that. But, yeah, basically it's the chemical composition.
Well, Leanne, speaking of rovers, we've got what looks like one of those rovers that are on Mars in a little pen here. What's this?
This is a model. The visitor goes right down the other end of the exhibition, and they actually have to control this rover. It's a simulated Mars environment. We've tried to make it as lifelike as possible, although we've made the floor much smoother than Mars is. At the moment on Mars, we've got two rovers, or NASA's got two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, and they're collecting samples and analysing those samples. They can't bring them back because they haven't got any way of getting off Mars, but they're analysing those samples so that we can actually have some idea of what Mars rocks are made of. You can see it moving at the moment, so someone's obviously down at the controls. I think one of the most amazing things, and the thing that we tend to think of is that it's like moving a remote control car, but it's not, because the time that it takes for our message to get to the rovers is around about 8 to 10 minutes. So if we send a message to the remote control rover, it takes 8 to 10 minutes, and then for the image to get back to Earth, it takes another 8 to 10 minutes. So it's like driving a remote control car with a 20-minute lag in between. So it gets fairly difficult.
But your lag here is only in seconds, isn't it? Not minutes.
Yeah, that's right. It would just be too difficult. I don't know that the visitor's going to line up for 20 minutes waiting for the rover to move.
Okay. Now, this particular one, then, is about the size of the Pathfinder that landed there. How fast does it move?
Fairly slowly, about walking pace. It doesn't need to move fast because it needs to move far. It needs to be sturdy, durable, be able to go up and down hills. The latest rovers, the Spirit and Opportunity, are way more resilient than this one. And in fact, they tend to get bogged every now and then for a few months at a time. They are robots, and so they are designed to be able to get themselves out of trouble without us sending the messages. But yeah, because of the Mars terrain, they do tend to get themselves into trouble every now and then. As you said, this is a fairly small one. The ones that are there now are about 1.5 to 2 metres high, and what they do is put the camera about eye level so that it's almost a human's eye perspective of Mars.
Now, Leanne, the biggest controversy of the last few months has been PLUTO. And I see that here on this exhibition you have actually addressed that.
Well, we've actually had to. Being up to date, being a museum, we can't just ignore it. In August, the International Astronomical Union came up with a new definition of planets. And there were three aspects to being a planet. The first is that it has to be spherical. The second is that it has to orbit the sun, but not be a moon. And the third is that it has to have been big enough to clear its orbit. Now, Pluto fits the first two, but unfortunately it doesn't fit the third criteria because it lives in the Kuiper Belt, which is absolutely chock full of all sorts of astronomical entities. The thing that actually caused us to start thinking about Pluto's classification was the discovery of another Kuiper Belt object that was bigger than Pluto. That has now been called Eris, after the god of trouble and strife.
And it certainly did cause a lot of trouble and strife.
It caused an awful lot of trouble and strife, and it's still causing it. There are actually a number of astronomers that have actually refused to accept the decision and are still referring to Pluto as a planet. We have accepted the umpire's decision, and we're going with Pluto. It's meant changing all of our education kits. It's meant changing all of the information that we put out from the planetarium. But we believe that the International Astronomical Union have been all right up until now, and we'll go with their decision.
And what is the public reaction to the change?
A great deal of disappointment. Actually, at first, we were getting people saying, what happened to Pluto? Where's it gone? People need to understand that Pluto actually hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't been blown up or anything like that. It's just been reclassified. There was actually another planet that was once declassified, and that was Ceres, which is in the asteroid belt, that's between Mars and Jupiter, and it's actually been reclassified now as a dwarf planet, the same as Pluto. So where we lost one, we sort of gained another one.
Yes. And way back in, I think it was the 1800s, Ceres was in fact called a planet.
Yeah, when it was first discovered in the early 1800s, it was initially a planet.
So it's gone from planet to asteroid back to dwarf planet.
Yeah, it is. So it's been promoted. Where Pluto's got the demotion, Ceres has been promoted, yeah.
And you've got a little walk here where people can go along and learn about all of these planets and dwarf planet.
Yeah, we thought that it was really important. It's one of the major things on the school curriculum that students learn about all the planets. And with the new definition of a planet, we thought it would be a good thing to actually be able to compare the planets too. And we kept Pluto there because students can then compare Pluto with the other planets. They can see how small it is, and they can see just why it was decommissioned.
Now, Leanne, this exhibition has lots of interactives, and this particular one looks like we're in orbit with a space shuttle and the Hubble Space Telescope. What's going on here?
The idea is for you in the space shuttle to connect with the telescope in order to repair it. And so you're using thrusters and rockets and things to get yourself into position. And the idea is, of course, in space, there's nothing to slow you down. There's no friction to slow down the spacecraft. So you need to use your rockets to either push you forward or push you backwards in order to get yourself into the position that you need to be. And so in this seat, you have your controls, and basically you can move forwards and backwards, and then you've got rockets on the sides. and it's a matter of firing the rockets at the right time and the right angle to get you into position to fix the Hubble Space Telescope.
And what happens if you get it wrong? Do you crash into it or wreck it or go drifting off away into space?
Yeah, usually you go drifting off away into space, never to be seen again.
Uh-huh. Lost that science works.
Well, it could be worse, couldn't it?
The controls for the shuttle's robot arm become disabled. You and another crew person have volunteered to strap on space maneuvering units, or SMUs, and fly over to the Hubble to capture it manually. As team leader, you'll perform the actual capture. The other crew member, that's her out there in front of you, will act as your wingman, helping guide you on the approach.
Leanne, what's this silver cone in front of us here?
This is the command module from one of the Apollo missions, or it's a model of it anyhow. You can see the three astronauts there sitting sort of upside down. This was a fairly common sight when I was a little girl. But a lot of kids haven't seen this sort of thing before and are quite surprised by it.
So the Apollo craft took the astronauts to the moon, but a lot of people don't believe that anymore. How come?
They have been injected with a healthy dose of cynicism, I would say. There are a few cynics around that suggest that the moon landing never happened. And it got a lot of airing a few years ago. And I don't think students were actually given the other side of the story, whereas in my day we were told all about the moon landings and there was no cynicism. Now it's all, it didn't happen, and they don't actually know much about the history of it happening. So that's what we're trying to do, just show them how they came back to Earth, and it's a great model of it.
And behind us over here, we've got rather exciting interactive of a great whooshing. What's this about?
This is one of our most popular interactives. And it actually is a really great test of, do people stop and listen to the instructions, or do they just go hell for leather pumping? What you need to do is, there are two types of fuel that fuel a rocket. On the left-hand side is the liquid fuel, and on the right-hand side is the oxygen that is required. Now, so what we do, it's all simulated. You pump the liquid fuel to a certain level, and then you pump the oxygen to a certain level, then you push the button, and it will take off. Now, you don't have to pump the levels to maximum level. So the idea is for the visitor to pump to a certain level and see how high their body goes. And then they try again. And it gives you an opportunity just to see, all right, if I use this much fuel and this much oxygen, it gets to this level. But if I change it, it'll go to a different level.
Now, they're not actually pumping in real oxidizer and real rocket fuel, are they?
No, they're not.
So how's that working?
It's actually water and air. And I've actually worked out how to get it to shoot right out of the tube. But you see a lot of kids who are very enthusiastic, pumping like anything, and it goes up about 3 centimetres. So it's all a matter of just pumping very slowly to the maximum level and then pump the oxidising.
Well, let's give it a go, Leanne. You can't.
Yeah.
Leanne, the display in front of us now looks like it just came straight out of one of the department stores in Bourke Street Mall or one of the shopping malls. What exactly is it?
These are some of the everyday objects that we use that have their roots in the space program. All of these objects at some point have come from space research. Now, some of the examples there are, say, for example, the Bluetooth, or all headsets and things like that were used so that the astronauts didn't have wires dangling down everywhere and had their hands free. The Dustbusters are classic, so that they could gather things up in zero gravity without having to get out their huge vacuum cleaner. The golf ball is interesting. It's not from the golf ball on the moon. It's actually the aerodynamics of the golf ball is from the space program. And of course, the astronaut pen that astronauts did have to write in zero gravity, apparently. And so they needed a pen that didn't rely on gravity. So if you think of all of our ballpoint pens, they actually rely on gravity to work. We also have some other spin-offs in the planetarium foyer, such as the ear thermometer and various other spin-offs. So there's lots of things that are actually developed to use in space that we use on Earth.
So how do the pens work, Leanne?
There's pressurised gas inside the cartridge, which pushes the ink towards the ballpoint, so the pen will work at any angle, even upside down. And not only that, it'll write on damp and oil-stained papers, and in the really hot and cold environments of outer space, and also in a vacuum.
Now, the Russians solved the problem of writing in space in a quite different way than the Americans. They simply used pencils.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Well, Leanne, thanks for our look around this exhibition. Could you tell us about the Science Works hours and how people can come to it and how much it'll cost them?
Okay, Science Works is open from 10 till 4:30 every day of the year except Christmas Day and Good Friday. And we're out here in Spotswood. Lots of public transport. You can come either by bus or the best way is by train. And just a lovely walk down from the station. It is free for children and pensioners and $6 for adults. And you can also come and visit the planetarium, which has got a number of different shows. You just ask at the door and they'll tell you what shows are on that particular day, and the lightning room too.
Thanks, Leanne, for showing us around.
My pleasure. Thank you.